Real College Podcast is presented by the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund and is a production of Radio K.
You're tuned into another episode of Real College Podcast, Quarantine Edition, and I'm your host, Casey McCabe. Happy Valentine's Day. Despite the pandemic, love is in the air this season, and although a cold front has settled over the cities, the days are starting to get longer and the sun is shining ever brighter as we near the end of winter. Whether it be friends, family, a significant other, or even your pets, there is a lot to love on this Valentine's Day. Here at Real College Podcast, we wanted to spread the love and bring you an extra special episode that we can all share remotely together. In this episode of Real College Podcast, we will take a look at how relationships have been affected by the pandemic, learn how to love ourselves, take a dive into the world of fish affection, travel back in time to Valentine's Day 1929, hear tales of tears, love, and turmoil, and an extra special installation of Radio K Sports Hour. You won't want to miss this. Be sure to stick around. Although college can be a stressful time to navigate personal relationships, the COVID-19 pandemic has made things even more complicated. Here to bring us the lowdown on how quarantine has affected our relationships is producer Emma Morris with more.
Since quarantine started, I have been having countless conversations with friends and strangers about the weather and other small talk topics. I was even having this small talk with those who I had close relationships with. Clearly, quarantine has affected the way our relationships are forming and being maintained, so I decided to talk to someone and get to the bottom of it. I had the pleasure of having a chat with Dr. Liza Meredith, a contract assistant professor in the psychology department here at the U. My first question was about relationships. How are they typically formed and how do we maintain them?
So we know a little bit about how relationships are formed. We know that oftentimes people pair up with individuals that are nearby them, which makes sense because that's how you find them. So we know that like college students, if they live in a dorm, are more likely to get involved with someone that lives close by. Like even if you're one door down from someone in the dorm, you're more likely to pair up with them than someone that's like 10 doors down. So proximity certainly seems to play a role. Also, even though there's kind of this like notion that opposites attract, we know that you tend to form relationships with people that are more similar to you. So if you have like similar interests or personality, it kind of makes sense. You're going to be drawn to be doing similar things and more likely to meet someone that way. And if someone like likes you, it's more likely that you'll start liking them back. So if someone shows interest, that can make you feel good and more likely to form a relationship. So yeah, I feel like being close to someone, sharing stuff in common, and then also someone showing like a reciprocation, those all help with forming a relationship. And then I feel like as time goes on and maintaining their relationship, it kind of depends on whether you're looking for the same thing, right? Like if one person wants a short-term fling versus like a long-term relationship, that's going to change how likely you are to like maintain the relationship over time. I feel like values play more and more of a role. Like do you think similar things are important in life? Sometimes that's not important in the short term, but like whether or not you stay together, that's gonna matter. So those are a couple things that come to mind right away.
After discussing how relationships are typically formed and maintained, I asked about COVID. How has this affected how we are now meeting people and developing those relationships?
Yeah, I think you're right. The pandemic has changed everything, both for romantic relationships as well as friendships. I'll state the obvious that like people have different risk tolerances. And I think some people are like not seeing people at all, whereas for others, whether it's pandemic fatigue or not viewing it as much of a concern, like they're more willing to see people in person. So that all plays a role. But I think a lot more interaction is happening digitally. And that can be really challenging, especially for people that are really wanting to like find someone. I have a friend who is really wanting to find a partner right now. All of her friends are partnered, and I think she's feeling lonely living alone. And it's hard online to figure out, like, is this, like, she's using online platforms and like, is it this worth meeting someone? for in person or not. So that's really challenging. And sometimes you might think you have like a spark online, but then if you meet in person, like she did, she found she's not really actually interested in this person. So they were doing a lot of, you know, digital dates, chatting for hours on end, watching shows together. But then when they met in person, like the same spark wasn't there. So I think, you know, sometimes there might be a sense that there's more connection than really is there when you actually go to like do things together in person. Or like, I guess the opposite could be true. Like maybe you would connect really well in real life, but you just don't have the same like comfort online. So I guess all this is to say it can be hard to figure out if you're a good match when you're just seeing someone digitally.
Finally, I asked Dr. Meredith the question we have all been looking for answers for during quarantine. What can we do to maintain our relationships while also being safe and mindful of the pandemic?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a great question. I'm grappling with that too. Because it doesn't feel great just to have like conversation about the weather. Like you don't want to just have small talk all the time. But on the same token, it also feels really weird to have like super in-depth questions when you can't, I don't know, when it's online and it feels like you're sort of robbing yourself of an experience that like would be nicer to have in person. So it's hard to give advice that will work for everyone. But I think, yeah, the more you can, you know, talk about things that matter and that are important, it's probably going to feel more fulfilling, right? And sometimes it is really nice to like do something versus just talk. And so if you can get creative, like my friends and I have played some like Jackbox party games where we're like drawing and like creating captions. And it's just nice to like do a shared activity as opposed to just feeling like you have to catch people up on your life when you don't even have that much new to even share. So I think being creative and trying to figure out some way to make it more interesting than just like another random Zoom happy hour type event.
I then asked if she had anything else she wanted to let us know, and here's what she had to say.
Well, I would just say, like, having talked to my friends, like almost everyone is having more struggles in their relationship if you are already together with someone than is normal. Like, especially if you're living with that person, it's really hard, I think, to for me, it's like you just see the person so much more. And so you don't have the same space and time to kind of like decompress. So just if someone is having struggle, to know that they're not alone. I'm hearing that from my friends. I see it with myself. I hear it from my clients that I see in a counseling practice. Like, so it's wonderful if you're kind of in a unique situation and found the love of your life during COVID. But I feel like for many, it's a point of struggle, and to not feel bad about it. It is hard when you just don't have the same outlets and free time.
For Real College Podcast, I'm Emma Morris.
Although Valentine's Day has stereotypically been celebrated between partners, this year many will be spending it alone, perhaps against their will, due to the pandemic. Now more than ever, being able to love yourself and practice self-love has become a critical skill. Here to help us all understand how to love ourselves just a little better is reporter Shannon Brault with more.
It's that time of year again, and if you're like me and have been single for a while, it doesn't mean much more than seeing heart-shaped candy at the grocery store and TikToks of people trying to find a last-minute date for February 14th. What's different about Valentine's Day 2021 is that we're all still living in a pandemic that has uprooted every aspect of our lives. For many of us, it's hard to feel like what we're doing right now is even enough, but in times like these, it's more important than ever to be compassionate with ourselves, to give ourselves grace, to work on the relationships that we have with ourselves, and to practice some self-love. Now, you may be wondering, what even is self-love, and how do I practice it? Well, I wanted to explore this question by talking to students to find out what they love about themselves and what self-love means to them.
I think especially since the pandemic has started, I've really ingrained in my head that like self-care is like a priority, and like my mental health is a priority. Like obviously that's something I've always known, but I don't know, in the past couple of months or like past half year, whatever year, I feel like I've genuinely been trying to make it, like an actual priority of it, and like taking action on that.
Something I love about myself is my bubbliness. I think I try to do like a really good job of just like being focus on being like a light and like a positive energy, because something I've realized is like it takes effort. Like the energy you put out into a space is like, you can make that super intentional and you can make that intentionally positive or intentionally negative. So just trying to always have the intention of positivity.
So one thing that I love about myself is my ability to have like very deep relationships with other people. Like I feel like I connect with a lot of my close friends really well. And I feel like it's just because I'm always there for them and go out of my way to show them that I appreciate them.
I'm good at adapting the way that I interact with people to the situation.
Yeah, I'm really like passionate about a lot of things. And when I know I want something, I'll work really hard to get it, or at least even get close to it. So that's what I really like about myself. I know what I want. And when I want it, I work really hard to get it.
Every student that I spoke with had a hard time finding and saying something that they loved about themselves. So I sat down with Teresa Nutt, the co-director of the Integrative Health and Wellbeing Coaching Program at the University of Minnesota, to ask her about self-love and what it all means.
Yeah, oh, what a great place to start. I love that we're starting with definitions, because I think that's where people often miss, is like really being clear about it. So the way I define it, self-love is an interesting and tricky thing. And I think in our culture particularly, there's so much focus on youthfulness and beauty and certain things that sort of disconnect us from the essence of who we truly are. So to me, self-love is that acceptance and adoration of who I am at the deepest level and going about my life in ways that nurture and support me. And so that is my quick definition of what I think it is. Yeah.
Self-love seems like an easy concept when you see infographics on Instagram about the importance of valuing who we are on a daily basis. But in reality, it can be really difficult to love ourselves and to learn to love ourselves during a pandemic where there's so much uncertainty.
You know, it is really good to frame it in that context of, yes, we're going through unusual times and we're kind of spending more time alone. And a lot of us, because our culture is sort of distraction-based, all the technology, all of the things we can do to fill our time, we haven't been real connected to ourselves. And so my experience, I have a small private practice, and almost every single one of the women I'm working with will tell me the same thing. I actually don't know the last time I actually slowed down enough to think what I thought about something. You know, it is an interesting paradigm. And as a result of that, there's sort of, I think, in the beginning, an inner critic tends to come in, like, oh, you should be better at this. Oh, you know, there's kind of this critical voice that is there because we're reconnecting, and it's sort of strange. So I think number one on my list of things to do during the pandemic is exercise enormous amounts of self-compassion. Just like, be so kind to ourselves, be so patient. Kristen Neff's book always comes to mind because she has all these great practices, like just reminding ourselves that we are human and that we have all these feelings and that it's all normal, and life is not always a Hollywood picture, right? Which sometimes it can feel like it should be. So I think just some practices of nurturing and celebrating the little things in life are a great place to start.
In a time of pandemic uncertainty and college soul searching, I was really curious about the million-dollar question, do we need to love ourselves before we're ready to give to others?
Yeah, isn't it interesting? Like, it's such a catch-22. Learn how to love yourself, which is actually a lifelong pursuit. Let me start with that answer. It's a lifelong pursuit to learn to love yourself. And so I think this whole idea of waiting until you're just right, until you give love to someone else, is so Western, isn't it? Like, we are all flawed and we are all capable of great love, even in our flawed state. That's what I'm going to say first. And I think that, however, the one thing I would say as a caveat, and I'm a woman who's been divorced and was in a marriage for many years, I think there is something to be said for learning not to need the love of another to fill your cup, but to have it be a dancing partnership where there's give and take and equal support, and a sort of like it's a bonus package that you're in a relationship and you have love, but it's not a person depending on someone else to fill an empty void in them. I think that's where relationships get in a pickle. And so I would just say that out loud, is that I think the good dance of the self-love part is when I learn to meet my needs, know what my needs are, meet my needs, and ask for help from others when I need support in getting those needs met. Then when I'm in relationship with another, it's a whole different relationship, and it's much more fulfilling for both involved. And I think the last part is, isn't it challenging? Valentine's Day comes with so many Hollywood story tales about love, and it's not always that way. So there's many good things about it and many challenging.
So this Valentine's Day, whether you're spending it with another person or curling up under a mountain of blankets to combat the extreme cold, remember to give yourself some compassion. Remember that self-love is a lifelong process that we're all capable of. We're living through extraordinary times, and that alone is something to be proud of. Stay safe and stay warm.
Minnesota is home to 11,842 lakes, covering a staggering 12,000 square miles of the state's surface. The land of 10,000 lakes is nearly 9% water, according to the U.S. Geological Survey, and is home to over 6,000 rivers. I've always wondered, although love is in the air on Valentine's Day, is love in the water too? Do fish fall in love? To gain an understanding of our underwater residents here in Minnesota, I spoke with Dr. Andrew Simons, a professor here at the University of Minnesota in the Department of Fisheries, Wildlife, and Conservation Biology.
So there are about 163 species of fishes in Minnesota, and that includes about 10 invasive species or introduced species. And I was surprised to find that there are about 95 species of fish in the metro area. Now, a lot of that diversity comes from the fact that the Mississippi River flows right through there. So there's many species of fish in the Mississippi, but then of course we have a lot of lake specialists as well. Of course, this being the land of 10,000 lakes.
With over 100 different species of finned fauna calling Minnesota home, I had to know, do any of them fall in love?
I suspect that most fish do not fall in love. I suspect that their interactions are short, perhaps sweet, but short. And but the way they get together will vary depending on the species. So in many species, there are color differences. And so you may notice that, say, the males of one species are more colorful than the females of another species. And that suggests that the males are actually using color as a signal, perhaps to signal their attractiveness to the females. And so we see that a lot.
Dr. Simons explained some additional ways that fish go about attracting mates.
Then also many fishes will produce pheromones. So they'll release pheromones into the water, and those act as chemical attractants, and again, can bring the males and females together to spawn. We know that many species sing. They create sounds, and the sounds can travel for long distances underwater. And we have several species in Minnesota that we know create sounds, and I suspect that there are more. It's hard to study because water, especially stream environments, are very noisy. But there are many species of fish that do create sounds. And so those will be calling. Usually the males will call and call the females to them, and then they will mate. Some fishes build nests, so they'll build like some kind of structure, and then they will display, often visual displays, but also sonic displays as well, and call the females in, and then spawning will take place in the nest.
According to Dr. Simons, fish don't fall in love, but surely this cannot be the case. 71% of our planet is covered in water. How can over half the planet be without love? I need a second opinion. And thankfully, I was able to speak with Will French, a research biologist at the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources who studies fisheries. So, Will, do fish fall in love?
I would say, the way we know it, fish certainly do not fall in love. That would be the cynic in me saying that. It really is all about survival and fitness and reproduction for them. That being said, there are some species that exhibit some pair bonding for short periods of time, and some parental care type stuff. It isn't all just kind of, you know, broadcast spawning and then they're done with it.
Will went on to detail some local examples of fish that show more affectionate traits.
Some of the more popular species that people would know about would be like bluegills, for example, or bass, largemouth bass, smallmouth bass. That sunfish family of fish really around here are kind of the more, I guess, the more invested in the care for their nests and their eggs, and even in some cases, some of the fry, some of the young fish, the adults will do that. And generally, it's the males that are more invested in the care.
Aside from members of the sunfish family, some other local residents have interesting dating tactics, according to Dr. Simons.
So there's lots of different ways that this is done. I mean, the fathead minnow, which is, you know, a common bait fish in Minnesota, it has a fascinating way of attracting mates. So the male will find a cavity under a rock usually, and you can create false cavities in aquaria or in ponds if you want with broken flower pots and things like that. And the male will clean off the ceiling of that cavity, and then he will sing, he makes noises, and then he moves back and forth and has visual display and also releases pheromones. And then the females come in, and then she'll spawn, she'll drop her eggs on the roof of the cavity, and then he'll fertilize them. And then he'll stay and guard them. Once they hatch, they swim away, and then it's over. But so that even the most what appears to be the most mundane fish can have a pretty fascinating reproductive strategy.
Although the experts say that fish don't fall in love, maybe they can help us love our environment a little bit more. According to Dr. Simons, here are some things us humans celebrating Valentine's Day can do to love our fishy friends.
Sort of in a bigger picture, you know, one of the big impacts we have is climate change. So with climate change, we're seeing a gradual warming shift in Minnesota. And so many of our cool water species are under stress. And there are many ways of reducing that stress. And you can do that by reducing runoff into lakes, by reducing the amount of trees or development that you have around a lake, leaving it more in a pristine condition. That makes it much easier for the fish to survive. Certainly with stream fishes, reducing any kind of channelization, moderating flow of salts and other chemicals into the water, all of those will have an impact. And it's a very complex question. There's many, many, many things that impact the fishes. You know, they're sort of like all things in nature, they're hit by multiple stressors. But I would say an individual can keep informed, they can contact their local politicians, and they can support the DNR, which does a lot of great work in managing our local fish populations. But I'll end with this, you know, since this is your Valentine's episode, you want to know about fish falling in love. You know, the deep sea angler fishes, I don't know if it would call it falling in love, but they have a very interesting strategy during reproduction. And so they live in a deep water. It's very dark. The fishes, the individuals are dispersed across large distances. So it's very difficult for a male and a female to find each other when it's time to spawn. And so these male deep sea angler fishes, once they metamorphose from the larval stage, they're quite small. They have very large eyes and very, very large olfactory structures, nostrils. Their noses are very large. They have very good sense of smell. And they swim around with one task, and that's to find a female. And when they do, they bite onto her side. And then over time, they fuse with the female so that all their sensory structures disappear, and they just become this. Their circulatory systems fuse, and they just become this little bag of testes that's permanently attached to the female so that whenever she's ready to spawn, she's got a mate attached right there. So maybe that's falling in love.
Reporting for Radio K's Real College Podcast, I'm Casey McCabe. Valentine's Day is a day of love and joy, but in years past, it has brought terror and tears. Here to bring us back to one fateful Valentine's Day almost 100 years ago is reporter Isaac Maruyama with more.
It's February 14th, 1929. Even 100 years ago, couples were still doing the same kinds of things that we now associate with Valentine's Day. Going for a walk through the city, looking forward to a romantic dinner, maybe even buying a few last-minute gifts. But there was something different about Valentine's Day in 1929. There's a reason why I'm talking about it nearly 100 years later. Something happened on that day. Something about as far away from love and romance as you can get. That's because, on Valentine's Day in 1929, in a garage on the north side of Chicago, 7 men were lined up against a wall and murdered. Let's back up a bit. To fully understand what's going on here, you're going to need some context on the history of organized crime in the Midwest. Specifically, there are two people that you need to meet. One you probably don't know. George Morin, or as he was known to his gangster pals, Bugs, and one you've almost certainly heard of before, Al Capone. George Morin was the leader of Chicago's North Side Gang, and he and Al Capone were bitter rivals. In the years leading up to the St. Valentine's Day Massacre, the two men vied for control over Chicago's lucrative bootlegging business. Morin had taken over several saloons in the city that were run by Capone, and his Northsiders had even killed a few of Capone's close associates. Clearly, Capone had good reason to want Morin dead. So, a plan was hatched. Morin and his gang would be lured to a garage in Chicago's North Side with the promise of a shipment of whiskey. Four of Capone's men would enter the garage and kill Morin and his associates. The only problem was, on the morning of Valentine's Day, when Morin's North Side gang arrived at the garage, Morin wasn't there. If the killers had noticed, they might have called off the attack right then. But they mistook one of the Northsiders for Morin himself, and things continued just as planned. Two of Capone's men were dressed as police officers, while the other two dressed in plain clothes and carried submachine guns. They entered the garage and lined up seven of Morin's men against the wall at gunpoint. Then they opened fire. When the dust had settled, all seven of Morin's men were on the ground, riddled with bullet holes. The killers walked out of the garage in plain sight, with the fake police officers pretending to arrest their co-conspirators to give the impression that everything was under control. Miraculously, one of the victims, Frank Guzenberg, survived for several hours after the shooting, but refused to identify the killers. The St. Valentine's Day Massacre sparked a public outcry. People were fed up with mobsters and mafia bosses running their city, and the government started to crack down hard on organized crime. And it wasn't just Chicago that had a serious problem. Organized crime was flourishing in cities across the nation, even right here in the Twin Cities. This brings us to the second part of our story. There's one more person I'd like you to meet. John O'Connor, the St. Paul Chief of Police from 1900 to 1912. If you've ever heard about the so-called gangster era in St. Paul, where the city gained a reputation as a safe haven for bootleggers and bank robbers alike, well, John O'Connor was the guy responsible for all of that. After becoming police chief, he openly allowed criminals to stay in St. Paul, so long as they didn't commit any of their crimes in the city, and kept up a steady stream of bribes. And at least for a few decades, the O'Connor Agreement seemed to work. Criminals took refuge in St. Paul, and while major crimes took place in the rest of the state, the city itself was relatively crime-free. It's hard to get an idea of what people thought about this deal that John O'Connor had made back in the early 20th century, but I found a biography of O'Connor published in 1919 by the St. Paul Benevolent Police Association, and it describes the man in terms nothing less than glowing. Highly efficient, one of the shrewdest living detectives. Someone was even quoted that mentioning O'Connor's name in the hearing of any criminal in the country would evoke the comment, "St. Paul is not a healthy town for me." Now, whether that was willful ignorance or an explicit attempt to hide O'Connor's corruption, I don't know. What I do know is that St. Paul's protection of criminals continued long after O'Connor retired, and nobody really did anything to stop it. That is, until the St. Valentine's Day Massacre happened on that fateful day in 1929. The public outcry against gangs and mob bosses that it created, combined with the release of an exposé on police corruption that was published by the St. Paul Daily News in 1934, eventually led to the end of the O'Connor Agreement. By 1935, many of the city's police officers were either convicted or resigned. And with Prohibition over, crime bosses' largest source of revenue had dried up. The gangster era in St. Paul was officially over. The St. Valentine's Day Massacre isn't really something that most people talk about today. But, as you enjoy the most romantic holiday of the year, I hope that you'll remember this love story between organized crime and the law enforcement agencies that were supposed to control it. For Real College Podcast, I'm Isaac Maruyama.
Waiters, chefs, and hospitality staff are finally getting the recognition they deserve as truly essential employees during the COVID-19 pandemic. In addition to being essential to our economy and well-being, service sector employees also deal with customers on their best days and on their worst. In this next segment of the podcast, we will hear from reporter Ethan Olson as he uncovers tales of tears, love, and turmoil, all courtesy of essential employees. Here is Ethan with more.
The art of a love language is always a tricky one to master. For many, this can be an unattainable art, and unfortunate passerby become witness to an uncomfortable scene that no random wants a part in. For others, it may become a bit easier, even if not everyone understands it. In this case, perhaps three isn't such a crowd, like for one couple who was accompanied by a Pornhub shirt-wearing third wheel in a fancy Italian restaurant. Perfecting this art isn't for everyone, clearly.
There's a lot of tables that end in tears. Like, people end up crying. And not in a good way. Like, you never know why. You just end up, somebody's crying, the other person's quiet, it's really weird. Or I've had somebody mad once that ordered a ton of stuff off the menu and didn't eat any of it. Out of spite.
The only really funny story we have is when a couple broke up during Valentine's Day and it was extremely awkward and the gentleman cried at the table. That's about the only funny story we have.
Sometimes, even single diners like to get in on the action.
Yeah, so not working at Old Fashioned, but I've been a bartender for like 7 years in the area. Mm-hmm. And 1 year, this older guy, like 60-year-old, and I'm in my early 20s at the age, brought me a life-size replica of a solid high heel chocolate shoe. I don't know, it was weird. Also, unsure of how to even use a solid life-size chocolate shoe or where one would get one, but that was probably one of the weirder ones on Valentine's Day.
As someone who has worked in restaurants for a few years of my life, it is almost inevitable that you will waltz into an uncomfortable scene where neither person wants to talk to you, but you're just doing your job. These brave restaurant heroes brave the battlefields that are the tables with fighting couples, simply just to give them some water. But fear not all hope is lost for love in this world, and some people truly master the art of love and leave their restaurant workers without embarrassment.
So we have one of our coworkers that has worked here. He's been here from the start, probably about like 10 or 12 years or something. He had a lot of friends around town. And he had a few friends that really wanted him. They met at Text Tubs or had their first date at Text Tubs or something along the lines of Text Tubs was really significant to their relationship. And they knew the server really well, and they always came and like specifically requested that server. And they came and got married in the restaurant. And every year on their anniversary, they come back and they have dinner here as an anniversary event. And last year they came and they brought like a tablecloth and like some champagne glasses, because we don't have champagne glasses, and they like poured their margaritas into them, kind of like made it their own. I wasn't here for the wedding, because that happened like 6 years ago, but I was here last year when they came in and brought their tablecloth and everything.
I send all of my support to that taco loving couple, and they are truly a dream couple in the eyes of all restaurant workers out there. Thank you to the Capital Grill, Text Tubs Taco Palace, the Old Fashioned, and the rest that shared their experiences with us. If we can learn one thing from these restaurant-going couples, it's find someone who loves the food as much as you and run with it. Sometimes food can be the final step in mastering the art of love. As for me, this is Ethan Olson, signing out.
Before this extra special episode of Real College Podcast draws to a close, we will hear from May and Connor over at Radio K Sports Hour. Take it away, guys.
Hello, RCP listeners. My name is May Longo.
And I'm Connor Machner.
And as you know, Valentine's Day is fast approaching, and there's one thing it is closely associated with, which is love. And love can take many forms, and one form that we are particularly familiar with is the love of sports. So, Connor, why do you love sports?
Personally, I like it because, there's a sense of camaraderie with people that you probably haven't even met that you get to build not only through when you play sports, through teamwork and learning all these necessary skills that you'll need later in life, but also just the passion and camaraderie that it can bring as being a fan, watching the game, and how much passion and love you have for your team. What about you, Matt?
Yeah, absolutely. I think sports was the first thing that kind of bonded me to my brothers, I always detested sports until I gave it a shot. And then it turns out I thought they were as fun as they did. And so it has a little more sentimental value to me. It's super cool that all of Minnesota is bonded by the love of the Twins. And there's a common hate for the Packers. Kind of a beautiful thing. And like different people show their love for sports in so many ways. Jerseys, memorabilia. People spend obscene amounts of money on things that remind them of specific games or specific players or people. And then there are displays of love at sports, like the beloved kiss cam or the wedding proposals on the big screen. So tacky, but always so cute, and everyone enjoys that. Yeah, and I think there are a lot of specific instances that come to mind when I think of a profound love of sports. How about you?
I do too. I think that, you know, one of the main things you talked about was, you know, memorabilia and collecting items to bring you back to memories, because really what sports is remembering the really good times that you spend with not only the people around you and the ones that you love in these moments that mean just so much. And, you know, some instances are like those extreme man caves that you see in people's basements where, you know, floor to ceiling is completely covered in gear and attire and, you know, posters and stuff like that. Like, that's what comes to mind when I think of love of sports and just, like, you know, partying in the streets after a big win and stuff like that. Like, that's what really comes to mind to me.
Oh, absolutely. For me, when I was brainstorming who embodies the love of sports, I thought of the infamous Marlins man. Mm-hmm. He sat in view of broadcast cameras, most famously at the World Series wearing his Marlins jersey. But I mean, after he gained this attention, people learned about him and his story. And he's attended 27 Super Bowls, 94 World Series games, 90 NBA Finals games, and hundreds upon hundreds of baseball and basketball playoff games to date. And he's been a full season ticket holder of the Miami Marlins since 1993. So, to dedicate that much time and money to something, you gotta really love it.
Oh yeah, I mean, I couldn't imagine spending that much money on all those tickets. I would love to, but yeah. I don't think that's a probable thing. But right. I do commend him for that. That is some real dedication to the stuff that he loves, and that actually brought up something. I had read a story a few weeks ago about an old season ticket holder for the Chicago Cubs who used to sit behind home plate all the time. And he would always wear a pink hat, and it would stand out every time he looked, every time he looked behind home plate. And he said it was because he wanted to make sure that his wife knew that he wasn't out seeing other people, so he would sit back there. And she always knew if she saw the pink cap, he was at the game. So I just thought that was really funny.
That's fantastic. She'd rather have him cheat on her with sports than anyone else. Mm-hmm. I love it.
So another thing that came to mind was SEC football. You know, it's when you talk about obsession, like that is – a lifestyle for them. Like, it is a way of life. You know, the hatred is real, the rivalry is real, but also the love of their team and their school is also very much real. And everything that they do revolves around those Saturdays. And that's really kind of what sports comes down to, is just bring people together, you know, with a common love, with something that they really enjoy watching and being a part of is really important.
Absolutely. It's a cornerstone to some people's lifestyle. So as we approach Valentine's Day, I think that we should wish a happy Valentine's Day to sports, to our teams, to fellow fans. Happy Valentine's Day.
That's all for the Valentine's Day special episode. We have a whole lot of love for all of our listeners out there, wherever you might be. Thank you for joining us for this special episode. As always, stay safe, Minnesota. We hope you stay happy, healthy, and connected. Until next time, signing off for Radio K's Real College Podcast, I'm Casey McCabe.